I think that all my friends are dead, and the ones that aren't found recovery.
I think we can't define success as just a decrease in the number of people dying.
I do think that people don't understand what a terrible impact it can have on the whole family.
All this week on the show, we've been hearing reporting out of Ohio on the opioid crisis. Takeaway producer Alexandra Botee spent time on the ground chronicling the challenges of addiction through the stories of 41-year-old Lauren and 25-year-old April. And today in our third installment, how families are impacted when a loved one is addicted, overdoses, and survives.
Lori Arian is angry.
We've had so many tragedies where families have lost loved ones.
Lori is April's mom. We sat down together at the Melody Diner in her home city of Dayton this spring.
There's been initiatives created around that. There's been stories that have popped up about it, and I'm not minimizing that on any level. But I don't hear about families that are trying to keep their loved one alive, that are really in it, buried in it, chaos happening all around, trying to remain sane through it all. Help motivate your loved one, help keep yourself healthy. We don't hear about that. And it's brutal.
In late 2013, Lori founded the organization Families of Addicts to provide support to families going through this experience.
One of the first things I hear from families is they feel like they're all alone, like their situation is different. This should have never happened to us, so I don't understand why we're here. So they feel alone. They don't have really any good sounding boards to talk to oftentimes. So when they come to FOA, they're immediately accepted. They're not judged.
And they're understood, Lori tells me, because she knows what this all feels like. Her daughter, 25-year-old April, has battled addiction for nearly a decade. April recently overdosed for the first time and had to be revived with Narcan. Keeping tabs on April's location became a constant obsession for Lori.
We have an app that we use called Life 360. It's an app that she has on her phone and I have on my phone, and it shows location. So for like $7.99 a month, we have this locator. It tells me how many times she's on the phone, whether she's been in a crash, and all this. And so it's just a way for me to know that she's still moving, where she's at, if anything happens, you know, where she's been at. And it really follows her phone as opposed to the car.
April's overdose nearly killed her, and Lori was faced with a difficult choice.
So she called me, and she said that she'd overdose. She was crying that she'd overdose, and could she come home? I said no. And it killed me to do that, but I said no. I said, I don't want to save you here. I can't. I'm not sure I could handle it. I'm not sure if I'm going to handle it. And I don't want to watch you kill yourself anymore. But then as the story unfolded, it turned out that she was in an abandoned house, and she had wanted to leave because she didn't want to do anymore, didn't want to be a part of it, was freaked out, and was going to go somewhere. I didn't feel like that was a good idea. So when I found out those things, lots of conversations and a few criteria later, like you need to call to get back into the treatment center, you need to call your PO, I let her come back.
Lori estimates that she has personally spent between $10,000 and $20,000 in the last few years supporting April. As families struggle through this, there are just not enough resources and support available, she says. Her organization, Families of Addicts, has gotten two small local grants totaling just over $10,000. Those help cover rent for weekly support meetings in two locations. Beyond that, it has received no state or federal funding for its educational programs for families. Across Ohio, she tells me groups focused on the family have been left behind.
One of our members put it this way: it's us helping us. So part of that equation is us helping us doesn't necessarily get you funding. However, it's working. That's the thing. Do we want to fund things that are working or not?
I agree. I mean, I don't think there are a lot of services out there specifically for the families, and not a push for that.
That's Janet Kincaid, mother of 41-year-old Lauren Hamilton from Cleveland.
I'm an attorney, a wife, and a mother, and that's what I do.
Janet remembers the day she first found out about Lauren's opioid addiction, back in 2014, when her daughter missed a family trip.
So when she didn't show up I got really worried. My husband and I went over to her house. This was about 11 o'clock at night, I guess. And her car was at her house. She wasn't answering, and her dog was barking like crazy. And so we went to the police and asked them to help us break into her house. So they sent a fire truck over, and they broke in through a window upstairs. And then we were standing in the driveway, and they opened up the door from the driveway, and you could see down the basement stairs, and she was kind of sprawled on a couch down in her basement, and she looked like she was dead. So they told us to stay back, and you know, we were just panicking. At least I was. I couldn't believe it. And they brought her up, and I guess they gave her Narcan, and because they had her out front of the house, and we could hear her start shrieking. And then the ambulance came, and they took her to the hospital.
That began a long journey for Janet of trying to keep Lauren alive.
At that point, I this is something I thought you could fix, and I learned really quickly that it's not an easy fix.
You thought sending her to a rehab facility would be a pretty simple fix?
Yeah. I thought, you know, getting her off the drugs and getting her life back on track would work. I knew so little about this then, and I'm just a fixing kind of person. That's what I do for my clients, and I always think that we can make things better and make things work, and I was helpless with my daughter.
Finding treatment facilities for Lauren, facilities she could afford, even with a stable income, became a major struggle.
It got to the point where, you know, I was pulling money out of my 401k in order to pay for her rehab.
Like Lori, Janet and her family began to desperately track Lauren's movements.
My older son, he actually had a tracking device on her car and maybe in her phone so that he could kind of tell where she was. And he talked to some policemen and some police departments and stuff. He found out about some of her overdoses that way because the tracking, you know, they would show that she was in a hospital.
Janet doesn't think that Lauren ever knew about the devices. And these days, she wishes she hadn't known about them either.
As I look back on it, I think it might have been better not to know so much about what she was doing and what was happening with her. Because we really couldn't do anything. We were powerless, and so we had this negative information that we really couldn't do much about. Honestly, you know, I was waiting for the call to come to say that she'd overdosed and had not been found in time. I would not have been surprised. I don't want to say I expected it to happen, but I certainly would not have been surprised to get that phone call.
Do you have a sense of how that changed your day-to-day, how that changed your own health or well-being?
I had gone into counseling myself. I went back to church. I had not been attending church for a number of years, but I found that to be helpful. A lot of stress between my current husband and me as a result of this because of the tremendous costs that we were incurring. And, you know, he believed more in tough love, whereas I was like, I've got to do whatever I can to keep her from dying.
After I spoke with Janet that first time, I got an early morning text message the next day. After talking to you, I've done a lot of remembering of things I have repressed or buried, it read. So I called her back.
After we got off the phone, memories started flooding back. And I think the most difficult one that I remember, you know, Lauren was fighting to break the addiction. She was in unbearable pain. She was feeling hopeless, just wanted to die. I was feeling hopeless and so helpless because I wasn't able to do anything for her. And I remember thinking that we would have all been better off, and especially her, if she had just died during that first overdose, you know, when she was very close to death. because it seemed like this was never ending and nobody should have to go through what she was going through.
Today, Lauren is sober. She's almost hit her one-year mark. And Janet says their family is in a good place.
I'm incredibly proud of her because I've seen her at the lowest when she couldn't beat it and she wanted nothing other than to die.
But back in Dayton, April is still actively battling her addiction. And Lori tells me she struggles with what that means for her.
I'm getting to the end of the line. She just doesn't want to listen to anybody. I'm tired. I've got a little grandbaby from my son. And so there's nothing wrong with saying this next stretch, we've been doing this for 9 years, this next stretch is now about me and my grandbaby and other things. We don't need to feel guilty or bad about that.
For The Takeaway, I'm Alexandra Boti in Dayton, Ohio.
Tomorrow, it's our last installment in Life After Overdose. We return to the women whose stories have driven this series and ask what their futures look like from here. Remember, you can find the whole series at thetakeaway.org/lifeafteroverdose.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.